That's the theme music from Game of Thrones, the HBO drama that has people all over the world binge-watching. Binge-watching is defined as watching multiple episodes of the same show in rapid succession, and it's a lot easier now with streaming services like Netflix or HBO Go.
The popularity of binge-watching is part of a big shift in the world of TV. Television has evolved a lot in the last few decades. Think of the introduction of video and DVD box sets, and then cable TV, and now streaming services.
Clive James is a longtime television critic and essayist, and he just wrote the book Play All, A Binge Watcher's Notebook. He's a memoirist, poet, translator, critic, novelist, broadcaster, and the author of more than 30 books, and he joins us now to talk about binge watching. Clive, welcome to Central Time.
It's very, very good of you to have me. Thank you so much.
Well, did you ever think that you would see the era that we're in right now, where there were so many platforms to easily watch so many different kinds of sustained narrative drama that have people riveted?
I'd like to say that I predicted everything, and I would probably get away with it, because I used to watch a lot of television back in the day, but the truth is I didn't predict any of it. It came out of left field, out of nowhere, mainly out of the American cable systems, which suddenly started competing with the networks. And the networks had to up their game, and it changed the whole picture. And that changed the export picture, too. And really what's happening in a place like where I am, which is here in England, is that the American exports eventually become overwhelming to the point where the local product has to compete with them. Same thing's happening in Scandinavia. It's changed the whole world of viewing, and very much for the better, I think. I've been quite ill for several years, more or less confined to my home. But that's an ideal circumstance to be a TV viewer, because what's coming out of the TV set is so rich. So I wrote a little book about it, called Play All, which I think is probably in your hands now.
It is indeed. Now, you were writing about TV in the 1970s up to 1982, I think, for the London Observer. Looking at the American TV scene then, high quality, if I understand your writing correctly, is not a word you would use for it. You were not impressed by a lot of what was coming out
here. I would call it the steam era, and we've now moved up to the diesel era. But there was a lot of stuff around from the American systems, which, if you had sufficient faith, belief, and imagination, you could see might develop. But it was a big, big guess. Some of the crime series, especially, were very, very promising. So there are plenty of regular network stuff that's at the basis of all this, I think. I think the Rockford Files was the start of almost everything. And I could write you a pretty good article tomorrow about how the Rockford Files eventually turned into Game of Thrones. It's not as far-fetched as you think. It's the sort of the continuing complex story. The seeds of the thing were always there, but that's easy to say afterwards, isn't it?
Well, the Rockford Files to Game of Thrones—I never would have thought that. I didn't see a connection. I mean, like, we don't have enough time for you to write an article. But what is the connection between the two?
The connection is they're both terrific, and they depend they depend very much on the quality of what's written and what the characters have to say. When you think of Game of Thrones, of a character like the little guy. What's his name again?
Tyrion.
Tyrion. And then the big Lannister, that's Charles Dance, isn't it?
Tywin Lannister.
The stuff they're saying is written to a very high standard, and that high standard exists because programs like the Rockford Files once happened. People gradually realized that you could go on upping the game so that the dialogue became the hero. And although there were a lot of fascinating naked women in Game of Thrones, what really drives the thing is the quality of the dialogue. And it didn't come out of nowhere. It's a tradition. It's the furthermost development of a tradition. And it's not just rivaling the movies. It's replacing the movies. Very few movies are as well written as Game of Thrones.
What are some of the other recent shows that you see as part of this higher level, this higher game of television?
You mean of the box sets?
Yeah.
Well, there are some non-box sets that I think are of terrific quality anyway. Sorry, my mind doesn't work very fast anymore. But I'll catch up if I just stop and think. Because the one thing you can't do on radio is just stop and think. but it'll come to me in a minute what I'm talking about. But if you just stick to the box sets, I thought the thing that really got everything going was with The Sopranos. And then it was the wonderful one about the D-Day boys. It'll come to me in a minute. I'm going to have to look at my my list of contents here. This is slowing you right down. I apologize.
That's okay.
For it.
That's okay.
I know you mentioned, to pick up on something else, you said just briefly here, you mentioned great dialogue becoming the hero, and that makes me think of Aaron Sorkin, the creator of West Wing. What do you think about that one?
I think West Wing is of huge importance. It didn't have to be that good. That's what changed everything. But I think it came into being because The Sopranos had shown the way, and it gave a network the courage to make the big commitment, because The West Wing is a network show, and a very, very unusual network show. And I've just been watching it all again, and it gets better all the time. Sorkin really set the standard, and it stayed good, even though he had to say goodbye, because he only wrote four seasons of The West Wing, did he not? And then he had a collision with a mushroom or something, and had to quit. And I've followed his work ever since. It's all interesting, although I think The West Wing is still the peak.
We're talking to Clive James now, author of Play All, A Binge Watcher's Notebook.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What shows do you binge watch? What is your take on shows that we've talked about so far here? We've talked about West Wing, Game of Thrones. In the book Play All, we talk about The Wire and The Sopranos, too. You can call in now with your favorite binge watching shows at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You are feeding off the violence and the despair of the drug trade. You're stealing from those who themselves are stealing the lifeblood from our city. You are a parasite who leeches off
just like you,
the culture
man.
Of drugs. Excuse me? What?
I got the shotgun. You got the briefcase. It's on the game, though, right?
Clip from The Wire, one of the most heavily binge-watched shows, by me anyway. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now with Clive James. He's the author of the book Play All, A Binge Watcher's Notebook.
And we want to know what you're binge-watching at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page. Clive, before we go to our callers, The Wire, what did you think?
I love The Wire. I actually discovered it when I was in Australia. I was visiting Australia at the time. I saw one episode, and I thought on TV, I thought this is going to be enormous. And by the time I got back to my home in the UK, it already was enormous. And I bought the first box, and I couldn't put it down. In fact, I and my younger daughter are probably going to watch the whole thing again quite soon,
wow.
Even though we already know every bit of it.
You can say all the lines along with it. All right, let's go to our callers now. We got Donna first in Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what did you want to share?
Well, I want to let you know that my favorite thing to binge watch is House of Cards. But even a better thing is about 5 years ago, my husband and I, we invented a holiday around binge watching. It comes in the winter when there's a real bad snowstorm or something coming, and we just decide we're going to binge watch something, and I make food, and we just binge watch something and
not
on food all day long.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so great. Yeah. I want to come over, or at least steal the idea for that holiday.
It's added a whole new dimension to staying in, hasn't it?
Yeah, staying in is not so bad anymore. I mean, do you think that what Donna is describing isn't all that unique? People look for these experiences, and they're not maybe just throwaway days anymore. They're getting something out of it.
Oh yeah, I certainly am. I'm sort of confined to barracks now. but I've never lived more luxuriously. knowing that there's a new big binge experience coming up.
Thanks for that call. Thanks for that call, Donna. The Wire.
Sorry. I'm talking on top of you. Start again.
We'll go next to Adam in Milwaukee.
Okay.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I think we have binge-watched the life out of our Gilmore Girls collection.
Yay!
And one of the things that I liked was a comment Amy Sherman-Palladino made about writing the Gilmore Girls. She said that if you don't write down to your audience and you write up to your audience will rise up to meet you. And I think that's kind of stood the test of time. And it seems like every time we watch through, there's some new quip or something that we catch, not only because they're talking quickly, but because it was so artfully written and written with so much pop culture embedded in it.
Adam, thank you so much for that. And Clive, is that part of what's making the dialogue the hero, that the writing is...
I think that's one of the things that's transforming civilization. When I came in, you were more or less forced to watch The Love Boat. And now Veronica Mars is 10 times as good as that, yeah. 100 times. So the standard of ordinary entertainment has gone up out of sight, which is good for civilization, I think.
Do you ever feel like there's too much to watch? Sometimes I feel like I'm behind on my TV, which is something I never would have said before. I would have felt guilty about watching TV.
What you're complaining about is capitalism, the consumer society. There's too much of everything, which is a rather wonderful experience. You soon notice if there wasn't enough of everything. And right now, I'm miles behind. I should know all about this Westworld remake. It's an expansion, isn't it? It's an expansion of the movie that came out in the 70s. But it's obviously going to be marvelous. And I don't know anything about it yet. I'm only just finding out. And I imagine over there you're already watching it.
It's just hitting, and I don't pay money for the HBO, so I can't watch it yet. Clive, we're wishing you the best on your health, and while you're confined to barracks, I want to know, what are the next one, two, or even three series on your binge watch or binge rewatch list?
Well, the rewatch list is the interesting one, I think, because I and my younger daughter are binge-watching Scholars. We like to get in right in deep on the second and the third viewing and start asking the intricate questions. We might even watch Band of Brothers again quite soon. I love Band of Brothers. I go on and on with it. And it's full of English actors because it was made here in Britain. And so it took me a long while to realize that Damian Lewis was not an American, for example. See, there's a big coincidence there. Just about the time when Spielberg and Hanks want to make a big series about World War II here in England, want to make it right here in England, is the very time when English actors really get on top of the American accent. it's been decades when they couldn't do it, and now they can. And Damian Lewis, you would swear, is an American actor.
Nice. Well, there's so much to talk about when it comes to binge-watching, and so much to look forward to. Clive, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I loved it. I'm a bit slow nowadays, but one of the things that's keeping me sharp at all is binge-watching. Binge-watching is very good for you. You can mainline it.
We just heard binge-watching good for you. Clive James with us there. His latest book is Play All, A Binge-Watcher's Notebook.
That was so much fun. Where else do you get conversations like this? Pledge in support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're a little over a month away from the November general election, and while the presidential race has dominated the news, there's a significant political matchup right here in Wisconsin.
In 2010, there were 57 lawyers, zero manufacturers, and way too many career politicians in the United States Senate. Today, there are 54 lawyers, one manufacturer, that'd be me, still way too many career politicians, and now Senator Feingold wants to add another one, himself. Fixing this broken system will take the perspective of someone who's actually solved problems. 31 years of manufacturing taught me how. I'm Ron Johnson, and I approve this message.
He campaigned as a job creator. But Senator Johnson helps companies ship jobs overseas. Good manufacturing jobs just disappeared.
CEOs and giant corporations get richer.
Guys with families and guys like me, just gets harder and harder to get ahead.
We need an economy that works for people like me.
For people like me.
For people like me.
People like me.
I'm Russ Feingold, and I approve this message because Wisconsin's middle class and working families should come first.
Sense of the advertising battle in Wisconsin. The race for one of Wisconsin's Senate seats pits current Republican Senator Ron Johnson against Democrat Russ Feingold, who lost the seat to Johnson back in the 2010 Tea Party sweep. And as we get closer to Election Day, both candidates are making their final cases to voters.
Joining us now to talk about the race for the U.S. Senate is Charlie Jacobs. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, before we dig into some of the issues in the back and forth, what are we seeing in the polls as we watch this U.S. Senate race?
Well, you know, there really hasn't been a whole lot of consistent polling in the state. We saw one come out from Marquette, which had Johnson trailing by about 6 points, well within the margin of error. When you added in the Libertarian candidate, we saw that slip a little bit more by about five. Emerson actually had a poll come out recently. It's a college out of Massachusetts, and they actually had the lead up by 10. So Feingold was leading by double-digit points. Now, you have to take into consideration that that is a different question, and they didn't pose a question regarding whether or not anyone was interested in a third-party candidate. So we have to be maybe a little bit suspicious of that. But all the polls recently, I mean, I'm talking consistently since the start of the year, have shown a relatively consistent and 5 to 6 point lead for Feingold. So we haven't seen much movement off of those numbers since very, very early in this race.
Looking at this race from outside of Wisconsin's borders, are people still seeing this as a very vulnerable Senate seat for incumbent Republicans?
Yes, I think that I think in many ways that horse is out of the barn. I think that vulnerability isn't a question anymore. It's more about how much Feingold is likely to win by. I mean, most of the predictor polls out there suggest that this is a 90% to 95% chance of a win for a Democrat. And I think that's in part why you're seeing some of the changes in support for Ron Johnson that were announced today.
Right. Some national party groups or national organizations starting to pull money out of the state that they'd been planning to spend on advertising. I mean, people maybe read too much into that sometimes, but do you think there's really a significant statement there?
I think there is a significant statement. You have to recognize that the party and organizations like the National Republican Senatorial Committee, they do their own internal polls, and they're reading these tea leaves to determine how to allocate the finite resources that they have. And you have to realize these races are getting so astronomically expensive. And even with the help of outside organizations that are dumping money into ad buys in the state, they're still responsible for trying to support these candidates. And usually what you see when there's a large ad buy that's pulled out of a particular district or a particular state, it means that the internals aren't very favorable to the candidate. And they'd rather shift the money to other potential winning states. And if you look at what the Republicans have to fight against this election cycle, they're probably thinking that $800,000 they're pulling out can help somebody like Toomey in Pennsylvania, or, you know, win a seat from Democrats in Nevada so that Joe Heck can maybe beat Masso. So, I mean, there's a lot of good that can come for Republicans from that $800,000. And if their perception is that Johnson is in trouble, they might want to use that money elsewhere.
Right, because the Senate as a whole is perceived as being at stake. It could flip from Republican to Democratic hands.
Yeah, depending on which predictor you look at, I mean, some say there's about a 60% chance that Democrats are going to win. Others have it as low as about 15%. It's really in play right now. And so I think there's a lot of jockeying for position and resources. And I mean, to be clear, I don't think that Johnson is being abandoned by the Republicans. I think in their calculation, they'd like to use their resources in a different place, recognizing that there are other resources that Senator Johnson has available to him. There are a lot of third-party buyers out there for advertisements. He's getting lots of support in that particular way. And so their calculation might be, you don't need our money. We're shifting it elsewhere. And so you find the resources you need to try to run that credible campaign all the way through to the November election day.
Before we turn to some of the particular policies of both candidates, let's look at the presidential race. How do you see the Trump-Clinton race affecting the Senate race in Wisconsin?
I think part of it is going to be turnout. Typically in presidential years, we'll see a spike in turnout. And when you have either a tight race or one where there's a perception that it counts in a very meaningful way, I'm not trying to say that other presidential elections did not count, but if there's some real salience to the public, you're going to drive up turnout. That typically will give Democrats a little bit of a boost. In off-year elections, we tend to see sort of a suppression of Democratic vote. They're not as animated and motivated to go to the polls. So if we see high turnout rates because of the presidential election, it's going to affect down-ticket races. Now, this is a confounding year. Sometimes it's really hard to disentangle exactly what's happening because of the effect of Trump's reputation and Clinton's reputation, and it's been a little bit muddy in the data to see whether or not it's giving a boost to Republicans down-ticket or Democrats down-ticket. However, if turnout goes up, Democrats tend to benefit in that kind of scenario.
We're talking to political scientist Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College in Pierre, looking at Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race, Ron Johnson, Russ Feingold. Charlie, voters sometimes might complain, oh, these candidates are all the same. You can't tell them apart. That's not the case here, right? If you're looking strictly at the ideological choice, at the policies supported, there's a very clear contrast here, isn't there?
There is. And Ron Johnson, I think, is, he's not unique, but I think he's among a small class of 2010 winners who have stuck and hewed pretty closely to those that helped bring him to office. So while I don't think he stands and waves the Tea Party flag, his partisan ideology matches pretty clearly. And so we can take somebody else who won in that period, who's now retiring from office, Reid Ribble. I mean, Ribble seemed to have recognized that he had a responsibility beyond one constituency, the Tea Party. And so I think he amended some of his approaches to governance because of that. And Johnson does not seem to reflect that. And Feingold has always been perceived to be somebody who is more liberal than your typical Republican and less likely to moderate on issues. So I think we have a real divergence in the party policies of these two candidates.
Yeah, looking at staying with Ron Johnson for a moment, definitely a lot of traditional Republican platform sort of things, lowering taxes, trying to boost jobs in manufacturing in particular. He's also had things that seem like they'd line up well with Trump supporters. On this show, he's talked a lot about border security, security with the Mexican border in particular, talking about immigration and terrorism when it comes to border security. Is he somebody who can appeal to mainstream Republicans and Donald Trump supporters who may not always agree on Donald Trump himself?
I mean, I think there's enough of a contrast between these candidates that they don't think that there's some symbiosis between these two candidates. I mean, Ron Johnson's rise to a position of prominence in the politics of the state preceded Donald Trump, and he has his own particular reputation. And I know that sometimes you have to ride the coattails of your party's candidate, but I don't see this enmeshing that would sort of be an albatross around his neck as we get closer to Election Day. Because of his manufacturing background, because of his connection to the Chamber of Commerce and those kinds of issues, protections of jobs, while yes, it resonates in the same way that Trump does, I think the tone is different, and I think Republican faithful can recognize that difference.
And then looking at Russ Feingold, progressive liberal type ideas on taxes, economic inequality. What do you see as his main message this time around?
It's interesting. I mean, he has a message, but it seems to be one that's safe, in the sense that he's not challenging sort of the orthodoxy of the Democratic Party, and he is not moving off of the positions that he took when he was a United States Senator. It's kind of like Feingold too. I mean, you're going back to the movies for a replay here, which I think is a strategy that could be useful to him. I think his perception, and probably his campaign's, is they just got sort of sucked into the vortex of 2010, and that maybe in a more favorable year, a presidential year, people would recognize the benefits he brought to the state as a Democratic representative. And I think part of that you see in some of the polls where people knew who he was. They had a high favorability. In fact, he has retained a higher favorability than Ron Johnson since January. In fact, even preceding that. So I think that sort of a second run at this, the repeat of the movie is sort of the strategy he took that was most appropriate here.
And in looking what the candidates are saying about each other, the campaigns, both have tried to draw sort of an ethics charge against each other. The Ron Johnson campaign saying Russ Feingold and his time away from the Senate set up PACs. They're saying, well, they're PACs that mainly just existed to support Russ Feingold for office. Russ Feingold looking at a payment to Ron Johnson from his company after he had run, claiming that, in effect, the corporation had funded his campaign. Do you see those ethics charges sticking, resonating with voters in either direction?
I don't really think that they do. The one concerning Senator Johnson seems to be something that's being relitigated here. I think most of the public was aware of his connection to his business interests, and I'm not sure exactly how the public is going to be driven to the polls or driven against a vote for Johnson based upon that. And the charges against Feingold, a lot of those areas of campaign finance and PACs are so esoteric that most of the public, including a lot of political scientists, kind of get lost in the minutia and the legalese of those. So I'm not sure whether that's going to resonate as a message to the public. Most people are interested in pocketbook issues. They want to hear policy debates about those kinds of themes.
We'll leave it there for now. Charlie, thanks as always for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Charlie Jacobs. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. He joined us to talk about the Johnson-Feingold Senate rematch.